Support for this episode comes from Lawyers Mutual Insurance Company, who have proudly provided California attorneys with specialized professional liability coverage for over 45 years. And did you know? Lawyers Mutual offers competitive specialty rates for their members who act as a neutral, either on a full-time or part-time basis. So, as part of their arbitration mediation specialty program, all members receive an individualized premium based on the areas of practice their firm handles. This allows Lawyers Mutual to adjust rates annually, and as you build your mediation practice, your premium will reflect the portion of your time spent working as a neutral. To learn more about how this great program can benefit your firm, visit lawyersmutual.com today.
Welcome to the audio edition of BHBA's Mediation Training. In this episode, your host, Phyllis Pollack of PGP Mediation, will guide you through essential ethics of mediation. Let's dive in.
My name is Phyllis Pollack, and as part of the Beverly Hills Training Bar Training Program, I'd like to just spend about the next 60 minutes talking about the essential ethics of mediation. So to begin, let's first look at an outline. And what we will discuss this morning or today will be, first, I will go over a definition of ethics. I will then discuss the model standards of conduct for mediators that was revised in 2005. I will then talk about the California statutes on mediation confidentiality, the California case law on mediation confidentiality, Evidence Code Section 1129 that was became effective in 2019, Evidence Code 703.5, which talks about the competency of mediators, or actually the lack of competency of mediators to testify, and then quasi-judicial immunity, and then finally the exceptions to mediation confidentiality. So let us begin. So the first question we have is ethics. How would you define ethics? And one definition of ethics is that ethics is broadly applied social standards to determine the right and wrong in any given situation or means or a way to determine it. It is a way that we can all get together and get along together in the world without chaos. Aristotle defined it the same way, as a means of outlining or establishing each person's obligation or duties to each other, to themselves, and to society as a whole. Now, while ethics is involves society as a whole, morals are our individual and personal beliefs as to what is right and wrong. And so that is the difference between morals and ethics. So in order to make an ethical decision, we need three things. We need transparency, which is the open sharing of important information. We need informed consent, which is agreeing to an action based on understanding of the action and its consequences. And finally, we need effective listening, which is grasping the speaker's meaning. As you will see, there are no clear-cut answers. Ethics is not always black and white. Why is it important? It is important to build trust, to build relationships, to create fairness, and to create transparency. So let's talk about the model standards of conduct for mediators. They were originally enacted in 1994 and authored by the American Bar Association Section of Dispute Resolution, the American Arbitration Association, and the Association for Conflict Resolution. They were revised in 2005. And when you're talking about the model standards, we're talking about three essential values, which I will get to in a minute. But what I would like to emphasize is that no one standard is absolute, no one standard has priority over the other, and no one standard overrides another. These standards are all aspirational. They are not rules of law or anything of that sort. What you have to do is look at the California statutes, the rules, and the regulations to see what they say. So, as I mentioned, there are three essential values. and they are dispute and autonomy, which involves self-determination, a party's right to make choices based on one's personal beliefs and values, free of coercion and constraint. And it involves informed consent, which is a very important concept that I will get to in a moment. Then it also involves procedural fairness, which is the fairness of the process to reach the mediated result. And the standards involved with procedural fairness include impartiality, conflict of interest, confidentiality, quality of process. The last value is substantial fairness. That is whether the outcome is good enough, whether the mediated result is acceptable. Now, some mediators believe that substantive fairness is of no concern to them, whereas other mediators do believe that they should be concerned about whether the result is substantively fair. I will leave it to you and your own moral compass to decide whether you think substantive fairness is an important value to you or not. So let's look at the first standard. The first standard is self-determination. And it states that self-determination is the act of coming to a voluntary, uncoerced decision in which each party makes free and informed choices as to process and outcome. Now, I've highlighted informed because that is a loaded word. And if you look at the California Rules of Professional Conduct, Rule 1.0.1.e, it defines informed consent as a person's agreement to a proposed course of conduct after the lawyer has communicated and explained the relevant circumstances, including the material risks and any actual and reasonably foreseeable adverse consequences to the proposed course of conduct. A more simple definition is found in Black's Law Dictionary, which means simply a person's agreement to allow something to happen made with full knowledge of the risks involved and the alternatives. So when you go back to the definition of self-determination, it is saying that it is the act of a party to reach a voluntary, uncoerced decision after the party makes a free and informed, that is, knows all of the benefits and risks and the possible adverse consequences of the decision that they are about to make. So let's go to the second part. So while we have self-determination, the standard then goes on to say that a mediator may need to balance such party self-determination with the mediator's duty to conduct a quality of process. And what this means is that while the party may have self-determination, the mediator may override it in the name of quality of process and make decisions separate and apart from that which a party may want. For example, the mediator may decide to hold a caucus, whereas the parties want a joint session, or the mediator may decide to have a joint session or a session with attorneys only, even though the parties disagree. The mediator may decide to not have a caucus confidential, whereas the parties may want it as such, or the mediator may decide to terminate a mediation against the party's desires or even to keep going against the party's desires. But then we go to A.2 of this standard, that while self-determination is key here, it then goes on to say that a mediator cannot personally ensure that each party has made free and informed choices to reach a particular decision, and so simply should refer them or make them aware of consulting other professionals to help them make that informed choice. So as you can sort of sense, this first standard is inconsistent, or there's tension in it, and that while the first part says that self-determination is all important, the second part says a mediator can override it, and the third part says that a mediator cannot even ensure the self-determination. Now, or that a party's made a free and informed choice. And when we're talking about self-determination, you have to think in terms of that it can involve either internal threats or external threats. And by internal threats, I'm talking about physical or mental conditions, such as a mental capacity or mental competency. And by external threats, I'm talking about situational ones, such as coercion, duress, ignorance of the law, ignorance of one's rights, or even time limitations. You know, for example, somebody has a plane to catch by 2 o'clock, and so the time for mediation is limited. Also, you have to think about how much information is sufficient for a party to make a self-determining decision. That is, some parties may want to know every bit and every scrap of information there is before making the decision, whereas other parties may not want to know anything. They just want to be done with it. They want out of there very quickly, sign on the dotted line, and let's go. And they do not want to know anything. So you have to think in terms of each party's own definition of self-determination. So let's go on to the next standard, and this is impartiality. And this is part of procedural fairness. And when we talk about procedural fairness, we're talking about the mediator staying out of the substantive side of the dispute and is simply instituting a procedure that encourages fair play and that treats the disputants with dignity and with respect. So when we talk about impartiality, the standard provides that a mediator shall decline a mediation if the mediator cannot conduct it in an impartial manner. And impartiality means freedom from favoritism, bias, or prejudice, and that a mediator shall not act with partiality or prejudice based on any party's personal characteristics, background, values, beliefs, or performance at a mediation or any other reason. Now, you ask, okay, is it okay for me to give information or advice to one party and not to the other? Many mediators will say yes. Other mediators will think perhaps you're being partial by doing that. Now, when we talk about impartiality, we have to distinguish that term from neutrality. Impartiality is defined as having no favorites. That is, during the process of the mediation, the mediator treats each party in the exact same way, takes no sides, regardless of their personal characteristics. Whereas the term neutrality means simply that the mediator does not interfere with the substance of the dispute. The mediator remains indifferent to the result and well-being of the parties and is disinterested in the result. Obviously, the mediator would like to see the case settled, but is not concerned with the particular terms. So in essence, impartiality is defined by the mediator's behavior and action during the mediation, while neutrality is defined by the mediator's lack of interest in the outcome of the dispute. And as I said, more specifically, the actual terms of any potential settlement. So let's go to conflict of interest. But before I do, I also want to mention one more point about impartiality. We all have biases. We all have implicit biases. We all have explicit biases. The trick with impartiality is to avoid explicit favoritism and bias in word and in action. That is, while we may have our own biases, we cannot show them. We cannot externally manifest those prejudices, biases, or favoritisms. In other words, we have to separate our feelings and views from our conduct and keep our biases, our prejudices to ourselves and treat everyone equally and impartially. So on to conflicts of interest. A mediator shall avoid a conflict of interest or the appearance during and after a mediation. This is going to be a reasonable person standard, and it can arise due to the subject matter of the dispute or from past, present, personal, professional relationships between the mediator and any participant that reasonably raises the question of whether the mediator is impartial. And as I said, context matters. One must make a reasonable inquiry into the facts. So for example, if I meet what turns out to be a party to my mediation at the grocery store and talked for 5 minutes, that doesn't create a conflict of interest. But for example, if one of the parties is one that I've been having lunch with every week for the last year, that could conceivably create a conflict of interest. So the context is critical, and inquiry must be made into the context. And as I said, it is a reasonable person standard. And if there is a conflict, you must disclose it as soon as practical, whether it's an actual or potential conflict. And the conflict can arise even after you've accepted the mediation, and you must disclose it. It is a two-step process. If you disclose the conflict and the parties agree to waive it, you then must ask yourself if the conflict might be reasonably viewed as undermining the integrity of the mediation. And if so, you as the mediator should withdraw, even though the parties are agreeing to waive it and do not feel that it is conflict. And then even after the mediation, you have to be careful about establishing relationships with any of the parties, because it may raise a question in terms of the integrity of the mediation. For example, whether your actions were in fact a quid pro quo, whether you've got some type of reward or additional income or recompense for the way you acted at the mediation. So even after the mediation is over, you have to be careful about your relationships with the parties. The next is competence. And obviously, a mediator has to be competent and has to have the competence that is necessary to satisfy the reasonable expectations of the parties. I've highlighted reasonable expectations because if you think about it, you would have to really cross-examine the parties to figure out what their reasonable expectations are. So I'm not quite sure how realistic this term is. Now, obviously, your competency will be based upon training, experience, and mediation skills and cultural understandings. And I do highlight cultural understandings because I think, as you're aware, County of LA or the Los Angeles area, Southern California, is quite diverse when it comes to cultural backgrounds. I believe that the Los Angeles Superior Court has interpreter services for more than 140 languages. So you have to be culturally sensitive when you mediate. If you take on a mediation and at a certain point during the mediation you feel that you're not competent, you have a duty to advise the parties immediately, discuss it with them, and if necessary, request appropriate assistance or to withdraw from the mediation altogether. And obviously, if you are impaired by drugs, by prescription medicine, by alcohol, or whatnot, you should not be mediating. You should simply postpone, terminate, or withdraw from the mediation. Now, confidentiality is something that I will get into more particularly in a few minutes, but I just want to mention the standard that obviously a mediator shall maintain the confidentiality of all information obtained by the mediator in mediation unless otherwise agreed to by the parties or required by applicable law. Now, California does have a mandated reporter statute, which is contained in Penal Code Section 11165.7. And this section lists over 43 different types of mandated reporters. Lawyers per se are not mandated reporters. Mandated, if you look at the statute, mandated reporters typically involve those in the educational field and in the medical field and elsewhere. For example, a emergency medical technician, a physician, a surgeon, a marriage and family therapist trainee, a coroner, a medical examiner, a social worker, a district attorney investigator, a peace officer are one of the over 43 different categories listed as mandated reporters. And if you are by chance a mandated reporter, that duty will override the mediation confidentiality. In other words, just because you are mediating does not mean that you take off your mandated reporter hat. It is still there, and you are obligated to tell the parties that you are a mandated reporter, so that if something comes up regarding elder abuse, elder neglect, child abandonment, child neglect, that you may be obligated to report it to the authorities. All right, so the next standard is quality of process, and this, I think, is a very important standard. And it provides that a mediator shall conduct a mediation in a manner that promotes diligence, timeliness, safety, presence of the appropriate parties, party participation, procedural fairness, and party competency. And A4 is important because it says a mediator shall promote honesty and candor among between the parties, and a mediator shall not knowingly misrepresent any material fact or circumstance in the course of a mediation. Now, some take this to mean a positive or a conscious misrepresentation, whereas others say no, mediation by silence or omission will be important as well. I take A4 to mean that you cannot misrepresent either by omission or by commission any material fact or circumstance in the course of mediation. Now, there are certain circumstances where there is a duty to affirmatively speak. For example, where silence would leave the other party in the dark about important information relating to the transaction, and that other party does not have access to that vital information. Where customs of the trade or other objective circumstances would lead a reasonable expectation to disclose, where there is a fiduciary or confidential relationship existing, where there may be a special statutory obligation, such as with insurance contracts, or where a party makes a partial disclosure that is misleading, or to update and correct previously disclosed information. These are circumstances where silence is a no-no because there is a duty to affirmatively speak. A5 is also important. I've highlighted the sentence, a mediator may provide information that the mediator is qualified by training or experience to provide only if the mediator can do so consistent with these standards. That means that as a mediator, you can provide information if you're qualified to do so. Now, there is a difference between information and advice. Information is simply providing the statute. For example, in a landlord-tenant matter, you simply tell the people what the statutes are regarding landlord-tenant law. Advice is when you go on and apply that statute or that information to the matter at hand. And this will become very tricky if you are mediating with self-represented parties because obviously they may not know the law. So you simply may feel inclined to explain to them what the statute says or what the law says. But invariably, their next question will be something to the effect of, well, how does that apply to me and to my case? At that point, you are giving advice and you are taking on the role of being an attorney as opposed to maintaining your neutrality and impartiality as a mediator. So when I teach this mediation ethics, I always tell my students that it's a very slippery slope between providing information and giving advice, and you really have to be careful in doing so. The next standard the next subpart is also important, and it says that a mediator shall not undertake an additional dispute resolution role in the same matter without the consent of the parties, and before providing such service, the mediator shall inform the parties of the implication of the change in process and obtain their consent to the change. Now, where this may come up is either doing a mediation / arbitration or arbitration / mediation. In a med arb, you may start out as a mediator, and if the parties can't reach an agreement, you then become the arbitrator, and this is where A8 would fit in,
or vice versa. You start out as an arbitrator, but you withhold your decision, and you withhold your decision, and then allow the parties to try to mediate to resolve it after they know all the facts. The next standard is also important. If a mediation is being used to further criminal conduct, the mediator should take appropriate steps, including postponing, withdrawing, or terminating. Note that I've underlined the word should, or I've highlighted it, which means you should do it, but you don't necessarily have to. If you read the model standards of conduct, you'll notice that in some places they use the word shall, which as we know is mandatory. In other places, they use the word should, which is permissive. And also note that this subpart says that the mediation is being used to further criminal conduct. So if the criminal conduct has already occurred, then this section may not apply. It's only when the mediation itself is being used as a criminal device. And then number 10 says that if a party has difficulty comprehending the process, issues, or settlement options, the mediator can make accommodations so that the party does have the capacity to comprehend, participate, and exercise self-determination. So this is all well and fine, but if you think back to the standard on impartiality, my question to you is that if a mediator does make accommodations so that one party can understand what's going on, is the mediator then being partial, contrary to the standard on impartiality? As I said before, if you look at these standards, you will see that there is a lot of tension or inconsistency among them, and you may find at times that you feel that you're getting twisted up like a pretzel in order to abide by all of them at the same time. Another standard, which I don't have listed here, and this goes back to the mandated reporter statute, is subpart B, and it provides that if a mediator is made aware of domestic abuse or violence among the parties, the mediator shall take appropriate action, which includes postponing, withdrawing, or terminating. And again, if you are a mandated reporter, you may have to take the additional step of reporting it to the appropriate authority. Now, subpart C, which is on the slide, provides that if a mediator believes that the conduct of a party jeopardizes conducting the mediation consistent with the standards, the mediator shall take the appropriate steps of postponing, withdrawing, or terminating. Typically, the only thing that you can do under these model standards of conduct when you feel that one of them is being violated is to postpone, withdraw, or terminate. Typically, you cannot notify any authority that is beyond the realm of these standards or the realm of what is permissible under these standards. So since I'm talking with attorneys, I will get into a couple of rules. But first, I want to talk about substantive fairness. As I said, some mediators believe it is important. Others believe it is not. So I will raise the question to you. Do you think you ought to be concerned about the fairness of the result? And how would you define fair? Would you define it based upon your own belief system, based upon laws or regulations or legal rules, or on your own approach to ethics? But now let's go look at some California rules of professional conduct since you are attorneys. Rule 1.12 provides that a lawyer shall not represent anyone in connection with a matter in which they participated as a mediator without the informed consent, written consent of all the parties. If they do not have that informed written consent, under the ABA model standard, then the lawyer would have to be screened from participating in the matter. The lawyer would not be able to receive any part of the fee and must give written notice of the fact promptly to all the parties. However, that is the model ABA rule. California inserted what I've highlighted as C1, that the prohibition does not arise from the lawyer's service as a mediator. And what this means is simply put that if you acted as a mediator in a matter, you cannot later represent the parties. And the reason that, and if you look at the executive summary to this rule, you will see that it notes that the provision excludes from the availability of screening lawyers who previously served as mediators or settlement judges. The change was made because permitting screening of settlement judges and mediators who not only receive confidential information from the parties but actively seek such information would reduce confidence in the administration of justice. The executive summary cites a case, Cho, C-H-O versus Superior Court, 39 Cal App 4th, 113 at page 125. It's a 1995 case that held that no amount of screening of a settlement judge who had received confidential information could assuage the concerns of the parties to the settlement discussions. So whereas in other states, a lawyer may potentially who acted as mediator may potentially later represent the parties. In California, because we've inserted this C1, it is an absolute no, and cannot be done. Now, the next rule of interest is Rule 2.5, which is lawyer as a third-party neutral. A lawyer serving as a third-party neutral shall inform unrepresented parties that the lawyer is not representing them, and the lawyer must take great pains to make sure that the self-represented party understands the difference between the lawyer as an advocate or representing a party and the lawyer as a third-party neutral who is acting impartially and has no favorites. And one of my colleagues actually may have self-represented parties sign a acknowledgement form acknowledging the difference and the fact that the lawyer is not there to represent them. So let's go on to confidentiality. And when we talk about confidentiality, we are talking about the ultimate self-determination, because a party has the absolute right to decide what information remains private and what information to share and not share. And so disclosure is strictly voluntary, which in essence is self-determination. And when we talk about self-determination, let me go back. When we talk about self-determination, we're talking about something that is intended to be kept secret. The notion of confidentiality refers to a voluntary agreement among parties to keep information secret. When you say something is privileged, you're simply referring to the protection of information from compelled disclosure. That is, you're talking about the ability of third parties to compel disclosure, and it is limited. So confidentiality is merely a voluntary agreement among parties to keep something secret. So let's look at the history of confidentiality in California. In 1965, Evidence Code Section 1152 was enacted. In 1980s, it was replaced by the confidentiality referring to mediation, Section 1152.5. Then Section 703.5, which relates to the incompetency of a mediator to testify, except in certain instances, was enacted in 1993. And then our present evidence code sections 1115 to 1128 were enacted in 1997. And then 1129 of the evidence code was enacted in 2019. So let's look at the model standard. More specifically, Standard 5, a mediator shall maintain the confidentiality of all information obtained by the mediator during mediation unless otherwise agreed to or as required by applicable law, and I refer to the mandated reporter statute, and required by applicable law is important, as I've noted. And if the parties to a mediation agree that the mediator may disclose the information, then the mediator may do so. A mediator shall not communicate to any non-party what went on during the mediation. As you look at the California Rules of Court and also the U.S. District Court rules, you'll note that the only thing that a mediator can report is whether the parties appeared at the mediation went forward, and whether the parties settled or didn't settle. You cannot go into the details of what occurred at the mediation, why it didn't settle, what the impasse was, or whatever. If the mediator participates in teaching, research, or evaluation, the mediator has to protect the anonymity of the parties and abide by their reasonable expectations regarding confidentiality. And when you meet with a party in caucus, for example, if you meet with party A in caucus, what goes on in that caucus, you must keep to yourself and cannot convey to the parties, to party B in another caucus, unless, you know, party A says it's okay to tell party B. So in other words, what goes on in caucus stays in caucus, and you cannot share it among the caucuses. And you have to promote an understanding among the parties to the extent that there will be confidentiality. And the parties can make up their own rules regarding confidentiality or use your own rules or accepted practices of what will be confidential and what will not be confidential. So why do we have confidentiality? Three main reasons. Trust in the mediator and in the process to strengthen the concept of mediator impartiality, to preserve the integrity of the process, or to sum up, to maintain trust, encourage forthright disclosure, and to preserve the party's faith in the process. That is why confidentiality is urged as being inviolate. Now, there are additional reasons to promote candor, to promote fairness, mediator neutrality, for privacy reasons, obviously, to protect the mediator. The mediator does not want to be forced to testify, does not want to be involved in any legal actions or be harassed in any way. Candid discussion during mediation often leads to successful mediations, and successful mediations will encourage their future use, and it will help the court because it will soften or limited their caseload and help them resolve litigation more expeditiously. So there are three levels of confidentiality. The entire mediation itself is confidential. What goes on in each caucus is confidential, and what you can't tell the judge or court or others. So in other words, if a case does not settle and the parties have to report for a post-mediation status conference, the only thing they can tell the court is that the parties appeared for mediation and that it settled or it did not settle, and that is it. So when you talk about mediation confidentiality, you're talking about two areas. One is evidence. It's a rule of admissibility. In California, our evidence code provides that it is neither admissible or discoverable. Other states may deem it to be a privilege, which amounts to the same thing. But it's also involved in mediation ethics, in that a mediator is constrained from revealing information to the other side or outside of the mediation in terms of what occurred, which means that you cannot post anything on social media. If you go to a party, you cannot start discussing what happened at mediation. You, as a mediator, you are constrained from disclosing or revealing information to anyone about what occurred during the mediation. So let's look at the California Evidence Code statutes. They are sections 1115 to 1129. And 1115 sets out the definitions. It sets out the definition of mediation as being a facilitated negotiation. It is a process by which a third party helps other parties assist them in reaching a mutually acceptable agreement. Now, be careful when you look at the definition of mediator, because it not only includes the mediator himself or herself, but it also includes any person designated by the mediator
to assist in the mediation or to communicate with the parties to prepare for a mediation. In other words, mediator includes your case manager or your assistant who is helping you set up the mediation. And this becomes important when you look at mediation consultation, because that means any communication between a person and a mediator for the purpose of initiating, considering, or reconvening a mediation or retaining the mediator. And what this means is that when somebody calls and talks to your case manager or assistant about setting up a mediation or initiating it, that is a mediation consultation. And because your case manager is defined as a mediator, everything that is said in that conversation will be covered by mediation confidentiality. So mediation confidentiality attaches the moment that somebody talks to your assistant about setting up a mediation with you or whether it is even feasible. Because if you look at the definition in 1119 A and B, it provides that no evidence of anything said or any admission of any writing or oral communication made for the purpose of, in the course of, or pursuant to a mediation or mediation consultation is admissible or subject to discovery, and disclosure cannot be compelled in any non-criminal proceeding, that is, in any arbitration, in any administrative adjudication, or any civil action. So as I said, from the moment that somebody talks to your case manager, that is a mediation consultation and is deemed covered by mediation confidentiality. Part C is a little bit broader, and it provides that all communications, negotiations, or settlement discussions by and between the parties in the course of a mediation or mediation consultation shall remain confidential. And this does include conduct that is intended as an assertion. So if you walk into a caucus and you ask a question and somebody either shakes their head or nods their head or raises their thumb, you know, or gives you a high five, some sort of assertive conduct, that will be covered by mediation confidentiality. So California Evidence Code 1120 essentially says that evidence that would otherwise be admissible or subject to disclosure as part of discovery does not suddenly become inadmissible because it was used during a mediation. So for example, if during a mediation you have the party using answers to interrogatories or shows you a video or a document that was produced in the normal course of discovery, it does not all of a sudden get covered by mediation confidentiality. It will still be admissible or otherwise discoverable. And in contrast, evidence that is created or produced solely for use in mediation will be covered by mediation confidentiality. There is a case called Rojas versus Superior Court, 15 Cal Reporter 643 or 33 Cal 4th 407, decided by the Supreme Court in 2004. And what happened was the owner of an apartment building sued the general contractor for mold and toxic fumes in the apartment building. And as part of the mediation, they hired experts to look at the toxic mold and other stuff and to make reports. That matter settled. The tenants then sued the landlord, and they wanted those expert reports. And the Supreme Court said, no, they are not available because the experts provided those reports on the mold and other toxic materials solely and only as part of the mediation, so they are not discoverable. Now, Evidence Code Section 1120 goes on to say that
the chapter does not limit the admissibility of an agreement to mediate a dispute, the effect of an agreement not to take a default, or an agreement to extend the time within which to act or refrain from acting in a pending civil action, or disclosing of the mere fact that a mediator served, is served, will serve, or was contacted about serving. And it also codifies the decision in Lapp versus Superior Court, which held that the declarations of income and expense or the financial disclosure statements required by the family code do not suddenly become inadmissible because they were used as part of a mediation. In Lapp versus Superior Court, the husband and wife went to mediation in order to settle the property and support obligations as part of a divorce, and their income and expense disclosure statements were produced. The husband later sought to have them excluded in a subsequent civil proceeding, saying they were used as part of the mediation. And ultimately, the appellate court said no, and the Supreme Court denied certiorari of the case. So the fact that a declaration of disclosure or your income financial disclosure statement is produced as part of the family code does not, and is then used in a mediation, does not suddenly cloak it with mediation confidentiality. Now, Evidence Code 1121 simply provides that you cannot be required to submit a report to the court, you know, regarding involving or including an assessment and evaluation or a recommendation of what went on at mediation. The only thing that you can submit, as I've said, is that the parties appeared for mediation and it settled or it did not settle, and that is it. Evidence Code 1122, I have highlighted Bay 1 because it says that the only way that a communication occurring during mediation will become admissible is if all parties who conduct or otherwise participate in the mediation expressly agree in writing. In other words, the consent of the mediator is also needed. And I think a lot of folks don't realize that they need the consent of the mediator in order to waive confidentiality. Many probably think that as long as the parties consent, that is sufficient. And so I wanted to point this out to you. Now, the next statute is extremely important. 1123 provides that the only way that a written settlement agreement that was prepared during the mediation is enforceable and that is admissible and is enforceable is if the agreement provides that it is admissible or subject to disclosure or words to that effect, or the agreement provides that it is enforceable or binding to words of that effect, or the parties agree, or that is being used to show fraud, duress, or illegality that is relevant to the issue in dispute. Now, there was another Supreme Court decision called Fair versus Beccari, 51 Cal Reporter 3rd, 871, or 40 Cal Reporter 189. There, the parties entered into a little one-page settlement memorandum or agreement, and the very last paragraph simply provided that if a dispute arose regarding the documentation of the settlement, the parties agreed to arbitrate. Well, as luck would have it, they could not agree on the documentation of the settlement agreement, so plaintiff asked the defense counsel to arbitrate, and the defendant said no. The agreement is neither admissible or enforceable. The trial court agreed. The appellate court reversed. The Supreme Court agreed with the trial court. Because the agreement did not have the magic terms in it, or what I call the magic words, that it provided that it was admissible or subject to disclosure, or that it was enforceable or binding, or words to that effect, the Supreme Court held that it was neither admissible or enforceable. And so the lesson to be learned is that in order to have a mediation settlement agreement enforceable or admissible, it must have these magic words in it. If it does not, then literally it is not worth the paper and the ink expended to create the agreement. Now, if it does come to pass that the parties file a motion to enforce the settlement pursuant to Code of Civil Procedure Section 664.6, the only thing that will be admissible is the settlement agreement itself. So the settlement agreement must be complete. It must have the backstory in it, must have all representations and warranties, because the court cannot allow any outside evidence or any outside explanations to be admitted. So when, as a mediator, you ought to advise the parties or suggest to the parties that the settlement agreement be as complete as possible, because if there is litigation over it, only the settlement agreement will be admissible and nothing else. So when does a mediation end? It ends when the case resolves in a settlement agreement, when the mediator or one of the parties sends a letter stating so, or 10 calendar days after the last communication between the mediator and the parties. And this time period can be shortened or extended by agreement. I often extend it for 180 days because frequently parties come to mediation and they realize that they need to do some more discovery. For example, take a deposition or request some documents. And so I typically extend it out to allow for that. So California Evidence Code 1126 basically says that what goes on in Vegas stays in Vegas. Anything said, any admission made during a mediation remains confidential to the end of time. And California Evidence Code 1128 essentially says that anything that occurred during a mediation cannot be mentioned in a subsequent civil proceeding. If it is mentioned at trial, it is grounds for a new trial under Section 657. If it's mentioned in a subsequent non-criminal proceeding, such as on a motion for summary judgment, then it would be grounds to vacate or modify the decision if the reference materially affected the substantial rights of the party requesting relief. Now, the last Supreme Court case on the matter was decided in 2011, and it is Castle versus Superior Court. And here the Supreme Court upheld the policy of the statutes stating that mediation confidentiality will override the ability of a party to a mediation to sue their attorney for alleged professional negligence. And in this case, Michael Cassell was sued or was attending a mediation in a business dispute involving trademark infringement or counterfeiting under an alleged global master license. And he met with his attorneys a few days prior to the mediation to discuss strategy, and then they attended the mediation. At the mediation, he was forced to settle on terms he did not like. And so afterwards, he later sued his attorneys, claiming that his counsel harassed and coerced him to settle for an amount less than he wanted. They threatened to abandon him at trial if he didn't settle. They misrepresented important terms of the proposed settlement and falsely assured him that they could make up the difference or the amount that he wasn't getting by a side agreement. They also said they would discount the bill, and they failed to disclose a conflict of interest. So he sues. The attorneys file a motion to dismiss saying everything was covered by mediation confidentiality, including both what went on in the strategy session before the mediation and during the mediation. The trial court agreed. The appellate court split the baby, stating that the pre-mediation strategy sessions were not covered by mediation confidentiality, but the actual mediation was. The Supreme Court agreed with the trial court, essentially saying that everything was covered. And it stated, we must apply the plain terms of the mediation confidentiality statute to the facts unless such result would violate due process or would lead to an absurd result never intended by the legislature. And when you talk about mediation confidentiality, not only are you talking about what went on between plaintiff and defendant, but even that which may occur between defendants, for example, or between an attorney and a client. If during a mediation, the attorney decides to change the fee agreement in order to make the settlement work, that will be that change in agreement will be covered by mediation confidentiality, so that if the attorney later reneges and it is not in writing with the language of Evidence Code 1123 included, then the client has no way to enforce it in court. Or if you have several defendants and they have agreed to a certain proportion of liability amongst themselves, that agreement also must be in writing with the language of Evidence Code 1123 in it to later be admissible and enforceable. So as a result of Castle versus Superior Court, the Beverly Hills Bar Association came up with a proposed suggestion to create a exception to mediation confidentiality for attorney malpractice. And it was subsequently submitted to the legislature, who then submitted it to the California Law Revision Committee, who studied the matter, came up with a provision. But the proposal of the California Law Revision Commission met with a lot of opposition, so it went nowhere. And so instead, a group of folks got together and drafted what is known as Evidence Code 1129. 1129 creates a prior disclosure or informed consent requirement, whereas the proposed legislation was trying to create an exception to mediation confidentiality or an after-the-fact type of arrangement. And Evidence Code 1129, as I said, is a prior disclosure informed consent that simply provides that an attorney who represents a client participating in mediation shall, as soon as reasonably possible before the client agrees to mediate, provide them with a printed disclosure containing the confidentiality restrictions that we have been discussing. And if the attorney is retained after an individual agrees to participate in the mediation, then again, as soon as reasonably possible, provide them with the printed disclosure and acknowledgement discussing the evidence code sections that we've gone over. The printed disclosure should be in 12-point font. It should all be printed on a single page, including the signature lines for the client and the attorney. And if the parties use the sample form in the statute, then they will have deemed to have complied. And the sample form starts off with a little introductory paragraph that is shown here. And then it provides specifically that all communications, negotiations, or settlement offers must remain confidential, which is in essence Evidence Code Section 1119C. It then quotes 1119 A and B, and it provides that a mediator's report cannot be submitted, which is Evidence Code 1121. And it provides that a mediator cannot testify pursuant to Evidence Code 703.5, which I will get to in a moment. And basically, the last paragraph is a summary of Evidence Code Sections 1115 to 1129. And what this means is that a party or an attorney should give this to the client prior to the mediation so that the client is aware that mediation confidentiality will apply and that there will be limitations on any possible redress that the client may have if the mediation it does not go to the client's liking. And so then you have the signature block. And then note, subpart E provides that the failure of an attorney to comply with this section is not a basis to set aside the agreement prepared in the course of or pursuant to a mediation. If an attorney does not comply with this, the only thing that the client really can do is file a complaint with the state bar about the attorney's failure to comply with this section. Now, Evidence Code Section 703.5 provides that a mediator is not competent or is not qualified to testify in any subsequent civil proceeding except in a civil or criminal contempt proceeding or about conduct constituting a crime, conduct being investigated by either the state bar or the Commission on Judicial Performance, or in a disqualification proceeding, or in certainly family law proceedings. Mediator immunity, there is quasi-judicial mediator immunity. The case is Howard versus Grapekin in 1990. And what this was this was a family law matter in which regarding custody and visitation rights over the minor son of the plaintiff and her former husband, Robert, Mrs. Howard sued the mediator, Grapekin, because she alleges that during the mediation, in a single six-hour session between the plaintiff and the defendant, the mediator acted negligently in that the mediator prepared a report that included false statements and omitted crucial information. She failed to disclose certain conflicts of interest and her lack of expertise in child abuse matters. And she alleges that the defendant, Ms. Drakin, was also abusive. And the appellate court said, no, we are providing quasi-judicial immunity to the mediator. She cannot be sued for professional negligence that occurred during the mediation. Now, finally, the last thing I want to go through are the possible exceptions to mediation confidentiality. As I mentioned, under the mandated reporter statute, if you are a mandated reporter, you may have to report child or elder abuse. There is a case called Tarasoff versus Regents Board of University of California. It's a 1976 California Supreme Court case, and it held that a psychotherapist who failed to warn third parties that a patient threatened serious bodily harm committed an error. And the issue here is whether this should extend to mediators. If we hear of a threat of serious bodily harm or criminal conduct during a mediator or during a mediation under this case, do we have a duty to report it? Called to testify as a witness that relates to the Evidence Code 703.5 that I just mentioned. In certain instances, we may be called, for example, before a state bar proceeding or before the Council on Judicial Performance. Reports to courts, our reports are limited, as I've mentioned, but also closely connected is that most mediator panels, and this includes both the Superior Court and the U.S. District Court, allow the mediator to discuss with the administrator issues that may arise during a mediation. Those discussions will be covered by mediation confidentiality to help the mediator gain insight regarding what to do about a particular matter. Disclosure regarding contesting a settlement, this relates back to Evidence Code Section 1123 and also the motion to enforce settlement under 664.6 of the Code of Civil Procedure. Disclosure regarding the possible misconduct of an attorney or mediator. As I mentioned, many of the court-connected programs have a quality control aspect to them so that if a mediator acted incompetently or didn't or acted, you know, as they otherwise should have, a complaint can be made to the ADR administrator who will conduct an investigation into that misconduct. And again, regarding the misconduct of an attorney, possible state bar proceedings. Mediation fee dispute, if you, as a mediator, you find you're suing for your fees, you do have to be careful about what is disclosed to the court. Courts can override the aspect of confidentiality. They can simply ignore it and saying, I don't care that it's confidential. Tell me about it anyway. There was a study done by James Coben and Peter Thompson who studied over 1,200 state and federal cases dealing with mediation between 1999 and 2003, and found that 152 cases considered the confidentiality claim. It was upheld 50% of the time. Those who rejected it did so without much reasoning. But more importantly, the study found that there were over 300 opinions in which what happened during a mediation was the issue, but confidentiality was not even raised. In 45 of those opinions, it was the mediator who was testifying. In 65 of those opinions, others were offering evidence of what the mediator said or did. And then in over 260 of them, the attorneys were offering evidence as to their own statements or conduct during mediation. And then the last is that there may be conflicting state laws. For example, if you have, particularly in the age of Zoom, if you are mediating across state lines, one state may have different rules on confidentiality than the next and may not honor your confidentiality agreement because it does not apply to their state laws. So even though California does say that mediation confidentiality is almost absolute and will be enforced unless there's a clear abuse of due process or produces a result that the legislature never intended, you do have to consider these possible exceptions to mediation confidentiality. So that is it. I thank you very much. If you have any questions, please feel free to either give me a call on my office number or my mobile number or to send me an email. And so I thank you very much for your time.
You may be eligible for CLE credit in your state. Visit bhba.org/podcasts for more information.